Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, HTL Quality, Is It a Better Target Than HTLC?, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Stephen J. Nichols, MBBS, PhD, FRACP. Dr. Nichols is an assistant professor of molecular medicine, cardiovascular director, Cleveland Clinic Coordinating Center for Clinical Research, Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Nichols has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Anthera Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Eli Lilly and Company, LipoScience, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and ReservLogix. He served as an advisor or consultant for Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, CSL Behring, Eli Lilly and Company, Esperion Therapeutics, Merck & Company, Omthera Pharmaceuticals, Roche, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. Dr. Nichols does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Nichols does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the importance of high-density lipoprotein cholesterol and HDL on coronary heart disease risk and novel concepts for modifying HDL function and HTLC levels. This activity is supported by Genentech. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Nichols, Assistant Professor of Molecular Medicine and Cardiovascular Director of the Cleveland Clinic Coordinating Center for Clinical Research at the Heart and Vascular Institute in Ohio. We have a very interesting and educational program for you today. For those physicians participating in this activity, please join me in a supplementary discussion on HDL functionality and its impact on coronary artery disease progression by clicking the Discuss This Case button. I would be interested in discussing your thoughts and questions around the need to raise HDL in patients with low levels and the importance its functionality plays in reducing the progression of coronary artery disease. How does the existing clinical evidence impact your approach to patient care? This dedicated discussion will allow us to offer better outcomes for our patients. Welcome to this program entitled HDL Quality, Is It a Better Target Than HDLC? Today I'm going to focus on the increasing evidence that suggests that HDL can be protective and talk about the current dilemmas in terms of what is going to be the right therapeutic approach in terms of promoting HDL to reduce cardiovascular risk. Is quality better than quantity, or is quantity better than quality? Let's summarize the data. Before we talk about HDL, let's kind of look at why we're so interested in HDL cholesterol. And that is that over the last two decades, we've had a large number of randomized control trials that have shown us that therapeutic strategies that lower LDL cholesterol consistently reduce cardiovascular event rates in both primary and secondary prevention, with evidence that the lower you can get your LDL cholesterol, the better you do in terms of reduced cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. However, at the same time, we observe a significant residual risk of ongoing clinical events in our patients. Even in the setting of large clinical trials, and this slide summarizes the major trials comparing statins to placebo in both primary and secondary prevention, as good as those therapies were in terms of lowering LDL cholesterol and reducing event rates, the best relative risk reduction we observed in any of those trials was 45%. That tells us that even in the setting of a large clinical trial, which patients are looked after very well, the majority of events continue to occur, and it tells us that we need to develop additional therapeutic strategies beyond LDL lowering to achieve more effective reductions in cardiovascular risk. One particular area that has received considerable attention is that of HDL, and there are a number of lines of evidence for why many of us in the field are excited about the potential on strategies that might target HDL. First of all, if one looks at the population data, we see consistent reports of an inverse relationship between levels of HDL cholesterol in the blood and the prospective risk of cardiovascular events. It doesn't matter what your LDL level is, what your triglyceride level is, there is a clear inverse relationship. On this slide, in fact, summarizes post-hoc data from the TNT study in which we see that on treatment levels of HDL cholesterol, even in patients who are treated with high-dose statin therapy and achieve a very low level of LDL cholesterol, less than 70 milligrams per deciliter, a persistent low HDL cholesterol in those patients continues to be associated with an elevated risk of cardiovascular events. So the population data is very clear. A low level of HDL cholesterol is an adverse marker for future cardiovascular events. The second line of evidence comes from animal studies. And again, we see very consistent observations that interventions that promote HDL, whether it be infusing HDL, whether it be genetic expression of its major proteins, consistently has beneficial effects on atherosclerotic lesions in animal models. This slide summarizes the seminal data from the Mount Sinai group, who really were the first to show that in cholesterol-fed rabbits, infusing HDL into these animals slowed the progression of disease. And in subsequent studies, after the establishment of atherosclerotic plaque, could actually regress atherosclerotic disease in these animal models. So the animal models very much suggest, just like the population data did, that HDL are protective. And then the third line of evidence comes to what we understand are the functional activities of HDL. The best characterized is the central role of HDL in the facilitation of reverse cholesterol transport. That means the removal of excess cholesterol from cells in the periphery, such as the artery wall, and taking it back to the liver via a number of different pathways where it can be excreted in the bile. We've also come to appreciate that HDL possess a number of additional functional activities that may also confer benefit at the level of the artery wall. HDL are anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, they're antithrombotic, they promote nitric oxide, and so putting all of those activities together, it seems that it's quite possible that HDL would have a favourable effect on both the size and the composition of atherosclerotic lesions in humans. So what can we currently do in terms of raising HDL cholesterol in clinical practice? We know that diet and exercise are important, and they do result in modest increases in HDL cholesterol. Those increases tend to be more prominent in patients who actually lose some abdominal weight. We know that statins raise HDL cholesterol by 3 to 15%. And in fact, we have data from both our own studies with intravascular ultrasound, and we've seen some clinical outcome studies show a similar story, that those modest elevations in HDL cholesterol do appear to be an independent predictor of the benefit seen with statins in those studies. Fibrates raise HDL cholesterol by 5 to 20%. Again, evidence from the clinical trials that where fibrates were beneficial, particularly with gemfibrozil, that small elevations in HDL cholesterol appeared to be important. And then finally, niacin, which is currently our most effective agent in terms of raising HDL cholesterol by up to 30%, with certainly long-term data from much earlier studies prior to the general uptake of statin suggesting that niacin had a favourable effect at the level of the artery wall and on cardiovascular events. So we've had a number of recent installments with therapies that are related in some way to HDL cholesterol raising that have somewhat confused the situation with regards to some disappointing results. First of all, we have the data from the ACCORD lipid study. This was a study of type 2 diabetic patients who were treated with a statin and in addition were treated with fenofibrate or placebo. As you see in this slide, the fibrate was associated with absolutely no benefit in terms of reducing cardiovascular events. We know that fibrates are PPAR-alpha agonists. They raise HDL cholesterol. And so we don't know to what degree that related to the lack of benefit seen in this study. It is interesting to note that in the ACCORD study, as with all the other major fibrate studies, we do see evidence that fibrates are beneficial in patients who have high levels of triglyceride and, interestingly, low levels of HDL cholesterol at baseline, suggesting that maybe you need to pick a specific patient population to have a benefit with a fibrate. at the American Heart Association meeting this year in Orlando, we've finally seen the public presentation of the AIM-HI results. This was an NHLBI study of statin-treated patients with cardiovascular disease and low levels of HDL cholesterol and high triglyceride. They were treated with extended-release niacin or placebo. The study was stopped prematurely in May of 2011 due to futility, and at the time there was also a report of a numerical excess of stroke, although as we've come to learn at the formal presentation at the American Heart Association meeting this year, in fact the p-value for that excess was not significant. There was considerable in-study titration of LDL cholesterol within the study. It wasn't truly an evaluation of niacin versus placebo, given the fact that there was a significant add-on therapy within the monotherapy arm in terms of titrating LDL. And as we've subsequently discovered, the difference in HDL cholesterol levels between the placebo and niacin-treated patients was only 4 milligrams per deciliter. So it really makes it difficult to draw too many conclusions about what to make of the results of AIM-HI. And then finally, the results of torcetrapib. Cholesterol ester transfer protein, or CETP inhibitors, are a new class of therapeutic agents which have attracted considerable interest as a result of their ability to be able to profoundly raise HDL cholesterol levels far in excess of anything that we can currently see with existing therapies. Unfortunately, the very first CETP inhibitor to get to an advanced phase of clinical development, an agent called torcetrapib, was associated with an adverse effect on mortality, an increase in mortality rate by 58%, and an excess rate of cardiovascular events in the order of 25%, in addition to a complete failure in terms of its effect to have any ability to modulate atherosclerotic plaque in 3 imaging studies. And it really did start to add to the question of, is HDL cholesterol raising fundamentally good or bad? And it also asks the question, is HDL cholesterol raising even the right target? We know that the relationship between cardiovascular risk and HDL cholesterol levels is non-linear. It is not a situation where your risk continues to get lower and lower and lower at the highest levels of HDL cholesterol. We know that that risk is largely driven by the fact that patients with low levels of HDL cholesterol are at a very high risk of cardiovascular events. We see variable findings from genetic studies, genetic polymorphisms that are associated with low levels of HDL cholesterol are not necessarily related to a higher risk of cardiovascular events. We see no direct relationship between HDL cholesterol measurements in the blood as a direct reflection of the ability to transport cholesterol from the artery wall to the liver. And then finally, HDL cholesterol has no ability to reflect other functional activities of HDL, such as its ability to modulate inflammatory and oxidative pathways. But in recent years, increasing attention is focused on the quality of HDL, with suggestions that the quality may be at least as important as the quantitative amount of HDL, if not more important. And there's a number of lines of evidence that suggest that this may be the case. The first line of evidence comes from some interesting post-hoc analyses performed by the IDEAL investigators. IDEAL was a secondary prevention study in survivors of myocardial infarction who were treated with atorvastatin or simvastatin. What they looked at was the relationship between standard deviation increases in HDL cholesterol levels and the relative risk for a subsequent major adverse cardiovascular event. Not surprisingly, it looked like as the HDL cholesterol went up, the risk for cardiovascular events went down. However, as they started the control for apolipoprotein A1, the major protein on HDL, and apolipoprotein B, the major protein on LDL, not only did you appear to lose that protection, but there was a suggestion that there might be an adverse effect in cardiovascular events. And what the authors concluded from that study was that this was being driven by a small number of patients who had very high levels of HDL cholesterol in excess of 100 milligrams per deciliter who had an event, and that this was a strong argument that one should not raise HDL cholesterol to very high levels. But there's another way of looking at this, and that is when you think about it, while simvastatin and atorvastatin do raise HDL cholesterol, they do so modestly. And so a patient on either of those therapies who has an HDL cholesterol greater than 100 milligrams per deciliter on treatment was probably greater than 90 milligrams per deciliter before they started the treatment. and these were patients that already had an event. In other words, their high HDL cholesterol didn't protect them. And really we start to ask this question, well, does that mean that there are other factors in play, or is it possible that there are patients who have high levels of HDL in whom their HDL is not as protective as other individuals? We know that there's a marked heterogeneity of HDL particles in the systemic circulation. They circulate in a wide range of particles in varying in terms of their size, their shape, the composition of various lipids, proteins. We don't know whether they're all equally protective. We don't know which is most protective, which is least protective. This has an important element as we start to try and think about, well, which type of HDL should we be targeting when it comes to new therapies? We also know from mass spectrometry studies that HDL has the capacity to carry a very large protein cargo. More than 80 separate proteins have now been identified to have the potential to circulate on HDL particles in the blood. And not all of these proteins have a role in lipid metabolism. Some of them are involved in regulation of the complement cascade, their acute phase response, other factors in terms of immune system regulation, inflammation in particular. And so it's highly possible that the various makeup of the protein cargo in a specific patient's HDL may have an influence on the ability of their HDL to be more or less protective in terms of cardiovascular risk. We now are able to start evaluating some of the functional activities of HDL when we take blood from human subjects in the lab, and we find some interesting observations. The first is that if you take the HDL out of the blood of individuals who have very high levels of HDL cholesterol but have coronary disease, in other words, their high HDL-C did not protect them, their HDL is pro-inflammatory. It actually promotes the migration of monocytes into the artery wall in cellular assays. We also know that some of these functional observations can be modified. If you take the same patients and you treat them with a statin, their HDL becomes less pro-inflammatory. In fact, it may, in fact, to some degree become anti-inflammatory. So we have the ability to be able to identify relative qualitative changes in HDL, and we may be able to follow them as a response to different therapies. In some of our own experience, we've even seen this translate to the non-pharmacological approach. This is data in which we've looked at the anti-inflammatory effects of HDL in the postprandial setting in healthy volunteers who have a high-fat meal. If that high-fat meal contains a polyunsaturated fat, their HDL becomes more anti-inflammatory over the course of the next 6 hours. It becomes more potent in the ability to inhibit the expression of the adhesion molecules ICAM1 and VCAM1 on the endothelial cell surface. In contrast, if your high-fat meal is predominantly that of a saturated fat, your HDL becomes less anti-inflammatory. It's far less effective in terms of its ability to be able to inhibit adhesion molecule expression. And so we have data now from the lifestyle setting and also the pharmacologic setting to suggest that we have the potential to be able to modify HDL functionality. We still need to be able to determine how that relates to cardiovascular risk. And that's been one of the major challenges. There's been a lot of investigators evaluating the functional activity of HDL, but we need very well standardized techniques that have clear validation with cardiovascular risk and cardiovascular outcomes. And this year we saw really what was a major breakthrough in this field, a landmark study by Dan Rader and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, in which they were able to show that the ability of your serum to promote cholesterol efflux was a potent predictor of protection from angiographic coronary disease in a large cohort of patients. So for the first time, we have a clear measure of HDL functionality that correlates with protection from developing obstructive coronary disease. We've been able to identify a number of factors that influence HDL functionality. HDL function appears to be impaired in the setting of inflammation, oxidative stress, glycation, and in novel chemical pathways such as carbamylation, a factor which is very prevalent in patients with kidney disease, individuals who smoke, and individuals with low-grade inflammation. It may be that having an impact on those factors may have an indirect positive impact on HDL functionality. Again, this needs further investigation. And then an additional question, and one that has become very important in the context of the types of therapies we're trying to develop today, is does cholesterol enrichment impair HDL functionality? This has been a proposed limitation of CETP inhibition. Inhibiting CETP, or cholesterol ester transfer protein, fundamentally results in HDL particles that are much larger and contain a lot more cholesterol than in the healthy state. Some critics suggest that by creating those particles, they become dysfunctional. They are no longer effective at promoting cholesterol efflux or facilitating reverse cholesterol transport, and that this may be a limitation that is associated with the adverse effects we saw with torcetrapib. There is currently, however, no evidence that CETP inhibition impairs either cholesterol efflux or fecal sterol excretion. This has been studied a number of times, both in animal models and in humans, and to date, there is no evidence of impairment of these activities in the setting of CETP inhibition. There is no evidence that CETP inhibition impairs reverse cholesterol transport in animal models. And then finally, our own experience, even with torcetrapib, shows that you can actually regress atherosclerotic plaque at high levels of HDL cholesterol in the setting of CETP inhibition. And that suggests to us that if you can still shrink your plaque, your HDL is still working to move lipid out of the vessel wall, and so its functionality must be retained. So as a result, there is a lot of excitement in continuing to develop CETP inhibitors. We've discovered that torcetrapib has various toxicities, and really now that we think that the functionality is intact, we ask ourselves the question, can we develop another inhibitor that's clean and move forward in large-scale clinical trials? And we're very excited that there's a lot of activity in this field. There are now three CETP inhibitors that are moving forward in clinical development. There's dalcetrapib, an agent that raises HDL cholesterol by about 30-35%. It has excellent safety data. We saw two great phase two clinical trials at the European Society of Cardiology this year, really reflecting the safety that we have with that compound. It has a fully enrolled outcome study, so hopefully within the next few years, we will actually be able to answer the question, does dalcetrapib reduce cardiovascular morbidity and mortality in a large ACS trial? We have a second compound called anacetrapib. We saw a large safety study of that compound at the American Heart Association last year. It's a drug that much more potently inhibits CETP, much more significantly raises HDL. It has some LDL lowering. Again, it's gone into a phase three trial and is actively enrolling patients. And at the American Heart Association meeting in Orlando this year, we saw the first phase two data for the third player, a drug called evacetrapib, very similar to anacetrapib in terms of the degree of CETP inhibition, the amount of HDL raising, some additional LDL lowering, and ultimately that will have to move forward as well. But one fundamental question that we have to ask is, are any of these drugs going to work? And if so, which of them are going to? Just because you are the most potent in terms of raising HDL cholesterol doesn't necessarily mean that you are the most likely to prevent cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. We need to learn a lot more of the impact of these therapies on the quality of HDL, and ultimately we need to know if they reduce events in big outcome trials. And this really becomes the challenge moving forward for any new therapy in terms of HDL. It's no longer just how much it raises HDL cholesterol. It's really critical that we understand what is the impact on that new therapeutic approach on the functional quality of HDL. We've seen increasing use of artery wall imaging to be able to evaluate these therapies because we know that the final common pathway of all of those functional activities of HDL ultimately is its impact on both the size and the composition of atherosclerotic plaque. And we can now see the plaque in the wall of the artery with much greater clarity, due to the evolution in a number of modalities that we're using in clinical trials. But ultimately, we need to take all these therapies into large phase three outcome trials to see if they're safe and whether they reduce morbidity and mortality. And so where does that really leave us? We have come a long way lowering LDL cholesterol has had a profound impact on cardiovascular risk, but there is a major residual risk. There remains ongoing hope that therapies that target HDL may be the answer. They may be the next blockbuster, whether it's by significantly raising HDL cholesterol, whether it's by promoting a particularly functional type of HDL, and so therefore the quantity isn't so important, we don't know. There's a lot of activity in this field, there's a lot of excitement in this field, and so we look forward to seeing the evolution of these agents as they move forward in the clinical development process. I want to thank you for tuning into this program. As a reminder for the physician audience, please join me in a supplementary discussion on HDL functionality and its impact on coronary artery disease progression by clicking the Discuss This Case button now. I am interested in discussing your thoughts and questions around HDL functionality and its impact on coronary artery disease progression and patient care. Join the discussion now.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, HDL Quality, Is It a Better Target Than HDL-C? To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.